This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
The oldest seed to ever sprout after dormancy was 2,000 years old, a Judean date palm.
This is a marvelous example of the extremes that are possible when a seed is in the right place to be preserved for a long time. And the record holder now comes to us from a place called Masada.
Plus, a snapshot of the economy. Economist Mike Doherty gives Ryan Denham Bloomington Normal by the numbers. And Laura Kennedy and the Psych Geeks tackle anti-heroes. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Thank you for choosing this GLT podcast. And while it's free to you, it's not free to produce. Please take a moment and make a contribution to pay for this program. Go to WGLT.org and thank you.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. An economic development expert says newcomers like Brandt and Rivian are hiring, and that's helping to insulate the local economy from changes at other big employers like State Farm. The Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council takes a snapshot of the local economy every quarter at its BN by the Numbers event. Economist Mike Doherty and the EDC's Zach Dietmeyer joined GLT's Ryan Denham to recap the latest numbers. Doherty started with local jobs.
Well, unemployment is up a little bit, but it's basically, if you look at June and July numbers compared to June and July of last year, or depending on which data set you look at, we're either up a little bit or down a little bit from last summer. So a sort of a mixed picture, but certainly nothing dramatic there in terms of employment numbers, kind of holding our own. Traditionally, Bloomington Normal in the summer, June, July numbers like this are usually lower than they are in the middle of the spring and in the fall. Those are maybe because of the universities or whatever, those are our higher employment numbers. So we're basically in line with last summer, possibly down a little bit.
Is there any sense that some employers are having difficulty finding people to fill certain types of positions?
Well, actually, it looks to me like they ought to be feeling a little bit of relief this summer because we had unemployment rates of 4.2 and 4.4% in June and July. That's up considerably from the 3.1% lowest level we hit earlier this year, which is to the point where we were basically running out of people. If you had somebody needed to hire people, you would have had a hard time finding them. So it looks to me like we've gotten – actually, we also had an increase in labor force numbers. Year over year, it looks like we may have had almost 1,000 people increase in labor force on our base of 95,000. So we're looking at about a 1% increase. But that was good news too. That kind of coincides with the national numbers. We're seeing this across the country where people who a year ago were saying, well, I can't find a job and I'm also not looking, now are saying, I'm looking. So they've read the papers, they feel like there are jobs out there and they're looking, and as a result of that, they are now registering as being unemployed, so you got a little more bump up in the unemployment rate.
Well, let's get into some specific industries here, and Zach Dietmeyer from the Economic Development Council might jump in as well. Let's start with retail. So in July, I'm seeing 9,400 retail jobs. It really has been lower than that in a couple of years. That feels like maybe a low point, but can you tell me what you see in the retail job numbers in our community as of this summer?
Well, I think if you track all the way back a decade now to the beginning of 2009, there really hasn't been much shift in those retail jobs numbers overall. It's somewhere around right around 9,500 at that point too. So very stable over the last decade. There's good and bad to that because that means that we're able to maintain those retail opportunities, but that also means that we're not necessarily growing at a rapid pace to include more employment in those areas. So we view it as a confident thing that people are still hiring. One thing we've heard from a lot of retailers locally as well is that customer service is such a priority with a new generation of consumers coming up. So they're focusing on employing more folks in customer service areas, which is a hopeful sign. And there's really no drop-off in those jobs thanks to that, but something we're definitely keeping an eye on for the future of retail.
Any other sectors you want to get into that you think have been doing something notable here in the last few months?
Well, one thing we always track is government jobs locally, and something that we hear come up from time to time is, why are our government totals so high here locally? So we started to look into how we can break down some of those numbers. So when you look at federal government versus state government and local government employment here, we see most of the fluctuation in those numbers, where it just seems to jump around from different points in the year. And really, when we broke it down, state government is where those changes come in. If you look at federal employment locally in those jobs, whether those are U.S. Department of whatever jobs, those have been pretty steady here over the last 5-6 years, between 400 and 500 locally. But the state government jobs, which would include the Illinois states of the world, those jump seasonally. So right now we're in a little bit of a lull with those. They're at right about 5,000 jobs, but those peak at about 7,500 in the school months. So what we'd expect to see here as the August and September and October numbers come out for those areas, those are going to jump up because that includes student employment, that includes non-tenured teachers coming back and the likes of those. And then the local government, you tend to see kind of in reverse. You see those peaks hit in the summer months when people are taking the jobs at the local Parks and Recs department and the likes of those. So something that we saw that we really wanted to point out, that it's not this influx of politicians being employed locally, but really how to break those down and show people locally how those jobs pan out.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm in studio today with Mike Doherty, an economist at the Illinois Farm Bureau who often studies the local Bloomington Normal economy, and Zach Dietmeyer from the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council. So, Mike, we talked about low unemployment rates, and it was in that 3-4% range, ticked up a little bit over the summer for reasons we just discussed. So with such low unemployment in our community, are we seeing wages go up as a result?
I haven't seen I don't think we have access to year-over-year wages like as real recent. You have to go back a ways. But certainly looking at the national and state numbers, they have been going up. Wages have been going up about 2.7 to 3.2% on average for the U.S. economy. And that reflects this tight employment market. Whether that's happening locally, I don't know. I would suspect so, though. I would expect if we went out and surveyed employers, they probably are finding they're having to increase some of their wages in order to attract new workers.
So what are you seeing in the housing market? We are nearing the end here of the busy summer selling season and buying season in Bloomington Normal. What kind of activity do you see in the housing market?
Well, in new construction, you know, we really haven't recovered there. I mean, we're down 37% compared to last year's numbers cumulatively through August on new housing. But new housing has been down consistently, new housing construction, for Bloomington Normal for a number of years. So it's not too much of a surprise. It's just even further down this year. The bigger market has been the resale market. That's where all the action's been at, and especially for Bloomington Normal. And what we're finding there is the year-over-year prices have been holding steady with last year, which, you know, is a glass half full. We'd like to see appreciation in those prices, of course, on a year-over-year basis for people reselling an existing home. But at least they are holding their own, and we haven't seen any decrease in that. And in fact, the sales volume, a number of homes being resold, increased quite a bit over the summer here, 10% compared to last summer. And that was good because that showed us that the market was catching up after having a really hard, long winter, which decreased the volume of existing home sales. So we've made up for that. We're in line or a little bit above the number of homes that have been sold through the year here, and even on prices.
As a reporter here in town, every month we cover home sales numbers. You know, the Bloomington Normal Association of Realtor sends those numbers to us. We do a story that say more homes are sold, fewer homes are sold, prices are up a little bit, prices are down a little bit. So based on what you just said, with sales being up a little bit year over year, prices holding steady, what do you think that says about the health of the local economy?
Well, given that the housing prices are not increasing nationally, housing prices have increased about 4.5 to 5% average for the United States year over year. That's August numbers over last August of 2017. It's interesting that in the, you know, Midwest has not been clocking in those kinds of appreciation rates as has the rest of the country. Those numbers for the nation are pulled up by what's happening in the coasts and in the sunny south of the United States. Chicagoland is notable that their prices have actually were down 2 to 3% year over year in June and July, and were even with last year in August. So, you know, keeping in mind that that's a very big market, does have some influence, kind of tells us what ocean we're swimming in here in Bloomington Normal. You know, it tells me that at least we're staying even or actually a little bit better than the entire 9-county area of the Chicagoland metro housing market. But we're not growing. If we're not growing income, if you had increasing incomes, as you're seeing, particularly in these high growth areas on the coast, people moving in with high incomes, you'd be seeing higher housing prices as you are seeing in other parts of the country.
And I know Zach Dietmeyer here from the EDC is very familiar with Brandt Industries and Rivian, two companies that came to town with help from the EDC and local governments who offered different types of incentives. Those companies are expected to hire a lot of people in the hundreds of employees, and that's already begun in both companies to a kind of a small extent, but it'll tick up over time. Is there any evidence, or are we seeing any impact on those companies hiring on our housing market?
I think that kind of helps play into some of these numbers. We've had so much concern locally in the community this year about corporate shifting and how is this going to impact our housing market, and the general sense, I think, was that it was going to be significantly negative, but that's been offset by other jobs coming into the community from those corporate entities. And Brandt and Rivian are already starting to ramp up that process. Brandt, I know, is expecting to be in a couple hundred employees in the near future, but I think what we see here is as those companies continue to ramp up, it does help stabilize some of these situations. Rivian is going to really, as they continue to take off, and as we see them in the next few months and even in the next couple of years, as they really reach those peak employment totals, we're also going to see other businesses want to attract to around those areas, suppliers that will bring in new housing opportunities and the likes of that. But what we heard from our realtor friends in this climate was that a lot of it was coming from new corporate traffic, from new job traffic. We've definitely seen that as well. And they've also talked about how rough this winter was on them. Really, it wasn't until late April, early May that they were starting to really get rolling for the year. And we see just how much of an impact that had here over the summer with it being such an increase.
And so, Mike, in your other job, when you're not talking about the Bloomington Normal economy with me here on the air, you work for the Illinois Farm Bureau as an economist. Yep. I want to ask if you have any insight into how the uncertainty in the agricultural world related to tariffs and trade disputes between the U.S. And various countries, is that playing out in any meaningful way in the McLean County economy? You've got farmers out surrounding our entire community who have concerns about their bottom lines.
You know, right now, for this season, luckily, we've had tremendous yields on our crops. Now, that's a very mixed picture, though, because it depends on where the rain falls. So we've got some parts of McLean County, and you go on up into Livingston County, where they've had a lot of variation in the yield on corn and on soy, and maybe a little less variation in the yield on soybeans. But that's what we're hearing across the state. So we still have to wait and see till the entire corn and soybean crop comes in and see what the average yields were. Those yields overall are expected to be very high, and that has helped. We also have a market facilitation program payment that's coming in, that's in the pipeline for the soybean crop, which is going to help boost the net cash farm income by the end of the year.
Oh, is that the federal, kind of not bailout, but a federal assistance program?
It's an assistance program for what happened to soybean prices due to the tariffs we put against China, and then China retaliated. Now they're not buying our soybeans, and our soybeans dropped about $1, $1.50 a bushel down below profitable levels, and the farmers really needed some in order to make current. Remember, that happened after the farmers had already planted their crop. They couldn't reel back time and say, oops, I wouldn't have planted that if I'd known that was going to happen. So so there has been that effect. You're going to see some effect. You're going to see some farmers are going to have to cut back even further, maybe decrease their total acreage that they normally would have rented in 2019. Those negotiations are happening at this time in August, September, and October. Also, their advanced purchasing on farm equipment and also input supplies, fertilizer, some of those are being priced for next year at this time. And as they look forward, they know they're going to have to be extremely conservative in their forward purchasing. I would expect a small effect.
I wonder if you can connect those dots then to a guy like me or a guy like Zach who are not farmers, right? So how does uncertainty and how does someone pulling back or being more conservative on buying a new tractor or what fertilizer use, how does that actually play out and sprinkle around to the rest of the economy?
You're going to see it more with the purchasing of inputs. For those businesses that do provide for our farmers in the local area with inputs, you'll see it more at like the tractor supply store, the farm supply stores out on the edge of town. You know, you're probably not going to see much impact on the more center, kind of businesses in Bloomington Normal, but more the ones that, and also in the smaller towns, you've got businesses out there in Pontiac and Hudson and places like that down in the southern part of the county. They're going to feel it more there because farmers make up a much bigger part of their customer base.
That's Mike Doherty, an economist with the Illinois Farm Bureau who studies the Bloomington Normal economy, and Zach Dietmeyer, who works with Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council. I'm Ryan Denham.
A lot of this data was presented last week at the EDC's By the Numbers event, a quarterly snapshot of the local economy. GLT is a co-sponsor of the series. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org. We don't want you to miss a single minute of Sound Ideas. That's why we're not interrupting Sound Ideas to ask for your financial support this fund drive. We're using station breaks like this one to remind you to help pay for all of the programs that you value. This week's fund drive goal is $25,000. We're working to reach that goal today because when we do, we'll be on the way to raising enough listener support to pay for Sound Ideas and everything else you value on GLT and NPR. But the only way that's going to happen is if everyone chips in, including you. Don't put it off. Help pay for Sound Ideas and help meet this week's goal. Contribute at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Heritage Health Therapy and Senior Care, exclusive providers of Restore Therapy. Restore Therapy, where your rehab and independence mean more. On the web at heritageofcare.com/restore. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, the triumph of seeds. The race for Illinois governor is going into the home stretch. Early voting is underway. The Illinois Politics Roundtable looks at how Bruce Rauner and J.B. Pritzker are positioning themselves. Sean Crawford moderates the panel, composed of IPR education reporter Dusty Rhodes, WTAX reporter Dave Dahl, and IPR Statehouse reporter Daisy Contreras. Contreras says Rauner looked well beyond the election in a recent appearance before the Chicago Tribune editorial board, saying he would never seek a third term.
He was saying, you know, I'm all for term limits and I'm only asking for one more to be able to complete what I couldn't do in the last 4 years. He went right ahead and he continued to kind of boast and say that he really wanted to continue doing right-to-work laws for counties, municipalities, so that they would be free of union regulation. And these are some of like the ideas that he's been pushing for the last 4 years. He wants less mandates on local governments and school districts. And he just, you know, kept pushing those same ideas. And, you know, it's hard. It's going to be hard. If he does get reelected, it's again, Democrats have been pushing against those same ideas for the last 4 years. So it's difficult to tell if that's going to happen.
Well,
we know
that Governor Rauner is struggling a bit with Republicans to get some of them back into the fold. We saw that become an issue in the primary, which he barely defeated Jeannie Ives. Dave, this sounds like he's trying to drum the base up a bit, you know, talk about right to work, things like that that seem to be more popular with Republicans. Is that what his angle is right here?
That's probably so, because you know that we're going to continue to hear about House Bill 40 and maybe even about safe or sanctuary states or municipalities. It's not going to hurt the governor, who lost 48% of the vote to Ives to try to get that base back.
Do you think this is going to work, though, Dave? I mean, it's, you know, here it hasn't worked for him so far, if you look at most polling.
Well, what is going to work for the governor? You know, what is his constituency? Who are the people who are going to say, we need four more years of Bruce Rauner? I mean, I'm not saying he can't win, but it's not a not an indefensible strategy.
And meanwhile, J.B. Pritzker was, as I said, at a college campus in Normal, Illinois State University, talking about higher education. And Dusty, what were the main points he was trying to make with this idea?
Well, he's announced a big plan to reinvigorate higher education in the state of Illinois, which definitely needs it. And you know, I feel like this is the 97th time I've said this into a microphone. We've been losing college students, high school grads who should be going to college. We've been losing them at a greater rate than any state other than New Jersey. So a lot of what he has proposed, J.B. Pritzker, is already in the bipartisan working group. You know, they're gonna keep doing this whether he's elected or Rauner.
Group of lawmakers working on higher education issues and maybe financing, funding, things like that.
Well, they've put forth a package of bills in the last session, and they're still meeting. I really am interested in what they're doing, but they meet privately. I'm not allowed to go watch. So some of the things that Pritzker has proposed doing is increasing MAP grants. He wants to expand eligibility for the Aim High, the merit-based financial program, so that 90% of Illinois households can benefit. One problem with that is that that's a match. So in one way, he's proposing giving money to universities. In another way, he's saying they're going to have to use that to match this expanded scholarship program. Some of this stuff is just already here. Ensure that community college credits transfer to public universities. That's an articulation agreement that dates back to 1993. We're really good at it here in Illinois. So the main thing is you don't know where these funds are coming from.
And that's the thing. I don't know anybody, Republican or Democrat, who doesn't seem to indicate that we should have strong higher ed institutions in the state of Illinois. We should support people wanting to go to college. At the same time, it's the cost where the issues always come up here and how you're going to pay for that type of thing. And there weren't a lot of details, if any, given during his stop in Normal.
No, I know he's proposed maybe gaming, sports gambling, and some marijuana assets,
legalizing recreational or something.
Yeah, but then he's also proposed using that money for other things. You can't spend the same dollar twice.
Well, that's a good point. And Daisy and Dave, I mean, I'm hearing that a lot from a lot, you know, at different times. People keep coming up with things that they want to see funded. More money going into K-12 education. They keep talking about sports gambling. They keep talking about legalizing marijuana. Again, there's a lot of other needs out there for the state, infrastructure needs. We, of course, have a lot of debt that we're trying to pay off. It seems as though, you know, again, we're in a campaign. I get that. But at the same time, you know, there's only so much money to go around, even if these things become a reality.
We're not hearing a lot of specifics from Pritzker. And in that sense, it gives him something in common with the governor. Who knows what he's going to do if he gets a second term?
Yeah, I mean, and for Governor Rauner, you know, if Pritzker were to provide any details, like, for example, with his progressive income tax plan that he's been talking about over the last few months and not offering any specifics on numbers on how he would structure that, gives Governor Rauner the opportunity to pounce on him and call him out on those numbers.
IPR State House reporter Daisy Contreras, WTAX's Dave Dahl, Dusty Rhodes, and moderator Sean Crawford make up the Illinois Politics Roundtable.
Why public radio? During this fund drive, we turned to GLT contributing listeners for answers.
Hi, I'm Jenny Keir.
There are a lot of answers, but also some common threads. It's fact-based, it's an avenue for lifelong learning, and it's local.
I feel like the news that I get on GLT is generally really, really fair and balanced, which is something that I really value.
What's your answer to Why Public Radio, and will you financially support GLT?
Please join me with your pledge now. Go online to WGLT.org.
Contributing to GLT is so easy, and it only takes about 3 minutes of your time, including the time you need to set up automatic monthly contributions. For $10 or $15 a month, you can help pay for Sound Ideas and all the other GLT and NPR programs you depend on. Just choose Ongoing Monthly Contribution when you click on Donate at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Cefcu, partnering with car dealers throughout Central Illinois to make the auto loan process quick and convenient. Competitive rates for qualified buyers. Online pre-approval is available. Cefcu, not a bank, better. Details at cefcu.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. In just a moment, we'll hear about anti-heroes with Laura Kennedy and the Psych Geeks. People don't think of seeds a lot unless perhaps they're pulling weeds and cursing, or if they're farmers, or maybe if they're buying sunflower seeds or nuts at the store. Biologist and award-winning author Tor Hansen says there is a lot more to seeds. Hansen presents The Triumph of Seeds, the title of his book, by the way, from 5 to 8 p.m. this Thursday at the Old Main Room of Illinois State University's Bone Student Center. Hansen says people should be thinking in much broader terms in appreciating seeds.
The impact of seeds on our life and our lives stretches out in all sorts of unexpected ways. The seed plants are the dominant plants in our flora, and so everything from natural systems to a huge range of human activities depend upon these essential plant parts.
Give a couple of examples, would you? Seeds have traveled across continents and been the currency in how civilization has advanced.
Certainly, yeah. So if we glance back at the history of seeds and our interactions with them, we can find all sorts of examples. I mean, we look back, perhaps a classic one would be to look at the Age of Discovery, when this North American continent was stumbled upon by Columbus and his colleagues at that pivotal moment in history. And we forget that what they were really after was not looking for a new continent. They were looking for, really, seeds. And if you look through the journals that Columbus and others kept of those early exploratory voyages, there's all sorts of botanical information in there as they explored this new world, searching for the seeds they were hoping to discover. Because at that time, what they were after and what funded that whole expedition and subsequent expeditions was the attempt to find a route to the Spice Islands, those places in Southeast Asia that were the sources of what were extremely valuable commodities in that day. Spices like nutmeg and black pepper, things that were seeds that they were after. And so we forget the importance of those seeds at that time for spicing food throughout Europe, and they were rare and valuable and much sought after. And like a lot of these stories, what begins with a historical story and a human story is informed by and depends upon biology, because the reasons that those seeds were so valuable and were so spicy and pungent has to do with the biology of the seeds themselves and the fact that plants pack their seeds, in many cases, full of all sorts of chemicals to defend them against seed predators. So that's just one example, but there are so many where if we examine closely the impact of seeds upon our lives, we not only see that they're pivotal to humanity, but also that those pivotal moments and incidences all relate to this fascinating biology of seeds as well.
So enlarge on that and talk to us about pistachios or cashews, would you?
Yes, the marvelous nuts that we love to eat. If you look at a nut and you break open a peanut or a pistachio, as you say, you're looking at the seeds and what are these two big, what they say in botanical books, cotyledons, generally speaking, for most of our nuts. They're these seed leaves that are packed inside there, and they're delicious to us because they're full of nutrition, fats and proteins that will be mobilized and transitioned into plant food to fuel the sprout as it grows. And because that energy is in there, then we can use it to feed ourselves. And that is one of those key seed traits that makes them so important to us. they evolved from spores. The spore plants, like ferns and mosses and things, came first and had been around for millions of years and were the dominant flora on the planet before seeds came along. There's a marvelous phrase that botanists often use when teaching about seeds, that a seed is a baby plant in a box with its lunch. So that lunch is a huge innovation. Spore plants didn't have that. And then there are other innovations as well. Because that lunch is there and all sorts of things, including us, want to eat it, then the plant must defend the baby plant and its lunch. And that gives us not only, you know, the hard shells that surround, say, the nuts that you mentioned, but also all those chemicals that we were talking about, chemical defense of seeds, which gives us spices and pharmaceuticals and all sorts of things. And then also, it's important to remember that the seeds are built to travel. So there are all these marvelous dispersal strategies for seeds, whether they are designed to be picked up by a squirrel and carried off, or whether they have appendages and wings that give them the ability to drift and fly on the wind. All of those adaptations for dispersal, or many of them, again, have uses for us. If you look at the plumes on seeds, you know, we use them for things like insulation, or we use them for the cotton that makes up so many of our clothes, those long strands that were designed originally or evolved for dispersal of seeds. And then another key trait that was an innovation of seeds was their ability to endure, their ability to last for years or decades, even longer, in the soil. That ability to go dormant, which is so critical for us in how we produce food.
What's the longest a seed has ever known to be dormant and then still germinated?
Oh, the record holder. Well, this is a marvelous example of the extremes that are possible when a seed is in the right place to be preserved for a long time. And the record holder now comes to us from a place called Masada, which is an old fortress that was surrounded back during the Roman times by a Roman army who were laying siege to a group of Jewish rebels up in this fortress at the top of the citadel. And eventually they overran the place. But it's a very important place in Israel because of this history of these heroic rebels who held out against the Romans for so long. And because of that, they did a marvelous excavation there in the 60s, very detailed archaeological dig, and they found all sorts of things, from coins and pottery sherds and all these sorts of things that go along with that kind of work, but also all sorts of foodstuffs, including, you know, olive oil and various other foods, wheat and things, some seeds there. But most notably, they found this huge store of Judean dates. And the Judean date was a very famous style or variety of date that was grown in the ancient world, an extremely valuable cash crop for the kingdom of Judea. And it since disappeared. No one grew it any longer. It had been gone for centuries. And here were all these date pits, and so it was quite a find. They were so well preserved. There were even bits of date flesh still clinging to the seeds. So these archaeologists, being, you know, good scientists, they numbered all these things and put them in a drawer someplace in Tel Aviv. And then decades later, some botanists got a hold of a few of these seeds and decided they should try to sprout them. And sure enough, one of those Judean date palm seeds sprouted and grew into a healthy tree after close to 2,000 years lying in the rubble of Masada.
This does not give me hope for weeding in my garden.
Well, no, it is the weeds are a challenge that continue for decades in many cases. Another one of the famous weed and seed longevity experiments was conducted in the Midwest, and was done at the behest of farmers who were curious about how long they would have to keep weeding these things out of their fields. And so a local professor at a college there gathered up a bunch of weed seeds and various other kinds of seeds, and he put them all into jars and then buried the jars in a location under the campus there. and set up a plan of digging up one of these jars every 10 years and seeing how many were still viable. And so, and it's still ongoing. There are still a few of these jars of seeds that are buried on that college campus, and every few years now, even though it's the original person who started this experiment 100 years ago is long gone, but the people, the scientists and botanists who've inherited it, still go out periodically and dig up one of these jars, and there are still seeds within those jars that are viable today.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Tor Hansen, the author of The Triumph of Seeds. We've heard a lot about the effects of climate change on animals. How is the effect of climate change manifesting itself in the way seeds operate in the world?
Well, it's an area of ongoing research, but there's a lot of interesting data out there already on how climate change is altering patterns, particularly of germination, in that we can see through long data sets where people have kept track of, you know, the sprouting of things in the springtime, year after year, that springtime is getting earlier for many seeds. But what happens that's interesting is you have, a couple of factors interacting that contribute to the germination of these seeds. And one is temperature. And of course, that's going up and it's often getting warmer earlier in many places in the spring. So that is one trigger. But another one is the length of day. And of course, daylight hours aren't changing at all. You can fiddle around with temperature all you want, but our position in the solar system the way we orbit the sun determines how long the days are. So daylight length isn't changing at all. So you have an interesting interplay there between climate factors that are changing and daylight factors that are also very important for seed germination that aren't changing. So some seeds are reacting quickly to this, and other species of plants are not reacting in the same way at all.
Who are the winners and losers?
Too soon to say. But one of the things that happens when you start tweaking these systems in terms of plants and animals as well has to do with interactions among plants and animals, and interactions among species that are reacting in different ways. And a classic example, and one that we worry about now for many plants and for their insect pollinators, is the timing and what they call a timing mismatch between pollinators and the flowers that they're seeking. In that, if you have a seed that is sprouting based on the length of the day, its germination time might not be any different. And those wildflowers, if you will, might be sprouting at the same time as they always have. Yet if you have them pollinated by a bee, for example, that is responding to temperature in terms of when it comes out in the springtime, it may be coming out early, earlier than the plants it's used to pollinating. And so you have the potential, particularly in systems of great specialization where a plant is reliant upon a single or a very few pollinators and vice versa, you have the potential then for these delicately balanced systems to begin to fall apart because of a mismatch in timing caused by rapid change in climate.
You are also the author of Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. How significant is that mismatch in parts of North America, and is the effect already detectable?
It's a great question, and again, it's something that we're, you know, people are very much looking at right now. The great fear is for these highly specialized bees and the plants that they interact with. And it's important to remember that we're talking about a great diversity of bees. You know, even here in North America, we're talking about, you know, approximately 4,000 species of bees in our bee fauna. It's very diverse, and worldwide it's 20,000 species. And while the bees we think about and are most familiar with are things like honeybees and even bumblebees that are highly social, the vast majority of bee species are solitary creatures, and many of them live these lifestyles that are highly specialized. you know, some are generalists, but many of them are specialized on particular plants. So as we see things changing quickly, those warning flags are going up about those real pollinator specialists.
Tor Hansen is a Guggenheim Fellow and a Switzer Environmental Fellow. In his book, The Triumph of Seeds, Hansen explores both the natural and cultural history of seeds, why they're so dominant in nature, and why we are so utterly dependent upon them. Tor Hansen will speak the afternoon of October 4th at ISU's Bone Student Center. Email horticulture@ilstu.edu to register or learn more. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Pop culture once idolized the hero, the White Knight, who took the high road to the rescue. Lately, our tastes have changed, taking a darker turn toward what we seem to find irresistible. GLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
Take a look across the cultural landscape, and you'll see lots of anti-heroes popping up like morally challenged meerkats. Characters like Walter White from Breaking Bad.
You clearly don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
Or Tony Soprano.
Are you in the mafia?
That's total crap. Who told you that?
Dad, I've lived in the house all my life. I've seen police come with warrants. I've seen you going out at 3 a.m.
So you never seen Doc Cusimano go out at 3 a.m. on a call?
Did the Cusimano kids ever find $50,000 in Krugerrands and a .45 automatic while they were hunting for Easter eggs?
I'm in a waste management business. Everybody immediately assumes you're mobbed up.
Or Scarlett O'Hara.
Fiddle-dee-dee.
And the list goes on. Dexter, Catwoman, Hellboy, Don Draper, and basically everybody on Shameless. These days, when it comes to characters, things are complicated. And we love it. We can't get enough of these complex men and women whose qualities are less than admirable, wrought as they are of flaws and shadows. As media consumers, our voracious appetite for more anti-heroes reflects our own inner complexity. That's according to GLT's Psych Geeks Eric Wesselman and Scott Jordan, who both teach at Illinois State University's Department of Psychology. Wesselman says the question of what defines an anti-hero is kind of squishy, and that it all depends on how you want to define it.
The early definitions of anti-hero focused on having a protagonist who is flawed, yet sort of overwhelmed by their situation, right? So some people I've read have talked about, for example, Willie Loman from Death of a Salesman. But a lot of other definitions seem to key on, rather than someone being overwhelmed by their situation, a more traditional protagonist who is capable, but does things that are morally ambiguous. Right, things that maybe we in real life wouldn't approve of, yet this person is still the protagonist. They're still the quote-unquote hero role. But we can't call them a traditional hero.
Yeah, I think there's an additional way to look at. One, we can do the taxonomy of what is an anti-hero. We can try to spell out the space. Another thing to do is ask ourselves, what does trying to make that distinction reveal about us? In other words, why are we trying to binary these people between hero and anti-hero? And in my experience of these characters, what we're really sort of grappling at is, what are the things that are acceptable in our time? When I think when people are having this conversation, part of what they're getting at is, what is it that we will unconditionally call good, and what is it that we're challenged to call good?
What attracts us as readers, as viewers, as curious individuals to an anti-hero? We see so many anti-heroes, no matter how you want to define them, in a lot of the media today. Sopranos, some of the superhero films that we see. One of my favorite anti-heroes was Maverick from the old TV series back in the 50s. So what attracts us to an anti-hero?
The writers are pushing the boundaries of what will qualify as good, even though these heroes, anti-heroes, might be saving people, defending the weak, defending the underrepresented. They're doing it with means that bourgeois culture might assume to be bad. Another way to look at all this is maybe the people that get to claim who heroes are the ones who are in the majority and in power. And a lot of these contemporary anti-heroes are actually people who don't have power, who aren't in the majority. And so by any means necessary, they try to help the repressed.
Eric, what's your take on that?
There are various theories on why people enjoy antiheroes, and there's probably a little bit of truth in all of them. You know, so some people argue that it's identification, right? That we see something of ourselves in them, and that could be different, right? You know, for some people it might be wish fulfillment. You know, I would love to go out there and be a vigilante in some situations, but I'm not going to because either I believe in my heart it's not right, or I just don't want to get caught. For other types of characters, like, for example, Dexter, who's, you know, a serial killer who only kills worse people, you know, some people have argued that maybe to enjoy that type of narrative, you have to morally disengage. And the data are mixed on that. I'm not as convinced by that theory. But I think this idea of realism is one that resonates with me, that in reality, humans are complex morally. And life is not a series of zero sum, like, this is the way it always, Scott used the word taxonomy, right? It's not always clear cut. And so these morally ambiguous protagonists reflect that ambiguity that we face.
If I followed up on that, I would argue that the only reason anybody ever believes that it's clear is because they have the ability to believe that. They're in a safe, fairly clear space that stays pretty much the same. And as long as those conditions hold, they're able to believe that things are clear. The contemporary, what we might call antiheroes that we're seeing in all the Marvel stuff on Netflix, these are people that aren't part of that safe culture, and it's never clear for them, and they all struggle for clarity. So on the one hand, we can say they're the ones that are ambiguous, and the other people know what's clearly right. We could also add the only reason they know what's clearly right is because they're in power and because things are safe for them.
When we look over the arc of popular culture over the decades, do antiheroes surface and dominate popular culture during certain portions of history? I'm thinking about, like, during the Vietnam War, perhaps the antihero was, you know, very popular and important for a cultural expression at that particular time.
You can look at them as transition states in culture. And when culture undergoes massive transitions, there's a reorganization of what is right, of what is stable. On my list, my number two antiheroes are Faust and Mephisto, who are characters in Goethe's Faust, written in the early 1800s, about a 15th, 16th century sorcerer or scholar.
But wouldn't the antihero exist in as an example of how not to behave, as sort of an example of, you know, hey, gang, as a way of getting away with putting up a bad character with a moral purpose?
Well, and so this gets at that idea of ambiguity and perhaps a continuum, right? You know, so we could set up an antihero as a foil for a hero, right? But also, where does that leave villains, right? And so if the sort of dichotomy is hero and villain, antihero might be that space in the middle, right? The one who walks the line, like Johnny Cash.
Who will do what the hero won't do because the hero would find it morally repugnant.
Yeah, that reflects the ambiguity that we walk in on a daily basis.
Yeah, as long as you recognize that the two ends of the continuum, the villain and the hero, are contextually dependent on that culture, right? Then the antihero could be seen as a culturally ambiguous space.
One of the only sort of traditionally psychological perspectives on antiheroes that I was able to find is written by a colleague of ours, Michael Spivey. He and his co-author sort of set up a taxonomy that has three dimensions to it. There's sort of the good or bad or good or evil means that a protagonist uses. There's sort of the good or evil ends. And then there is the certainty which with that character acts, right? And so looks at this very much like a continuum. The antihero space is someone who sometimes does the right things for the wrong reasons and other times does the wrong thing for the right reasons and has this struggle to some degree about what they're doing.
Does the dominance of the antihero in culture today herald a new social climate, do you guys think?
Yeah, absolutely. It's capitalizing on other aspects of culture, particularly Western culture right now. I think we're going culturally more holist. what I mean by that is we're coming to, the pendulum is swinging from the idea that we're all individual things in an empty space to the idea that we're all inherently connected to each other and all naturally about each other. And we're all part of one universe, dare I say. And I think you see the current anti-hero market sort of expressing the inescapability of context. We're all caught up in a real world. There's no way we can escape that real world other than through death. And we deal with the world as it is, and we're seeing the emergence, I think, of a type of hero who willfully walks into the beautifully ugly nature of reality. So instead of creating a story in which someone can end up being pure and clean at the end, I think culture's sort of giving up on that idea of purity and moving more towards an idea of engagement, embodiment, and contextuality. I think it's a sign of growth. I think you can sort of see a redo, a recapitulation in culture of what a developing individual goes through here, and that is an increase in complexity over the life course. And certain cultural zeitgeists come to be, and there develops a sort of clear, pure model of what that culture is about, what people in it should strive for. And over time, those things tend to dissolve, right? And they dissolve because the tensions for their dissolving are built into the system. So the irony of moments of cultural stability is that that's the way it's supposed to be, right? Nothing's supposed to be any particular way. Reality is a continuous flux. So I think the anti-hero is a sort of way for any culture, I mean, I talked about Faust earlier, to sort of dabble, tamper with, and look at what are the things that are keeping this stability propped up. We can call it an anti-hero, but I think that's just how we refer to it in the last 50 years. It's been around forever, and it's the inherent instability in any stable social system. And as long as people keep giving voice to it, which they're not allowed to do in oppressed societies, by the way, as long as they keep giving voice to it, like V from Vendetta, right, the growth will be possible.
That's Scott Jordan and Eric Wesselman, GLT's Psych Geeks, who teach in the Illinois State University Department of Psychology. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The Psych Geeks both listed their top five anti-heroes, some of which may surprise you. You can find the list on our Facebook page, where you are welcome to post your own favorite anti-heroes. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Thanks to Ryan Denham and Laura Kennedy today. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.